Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Christine Williams.
And you are listening to Fiber Talk. We do it twice a week. It's for people who play with needles. And yes, and Christine is in full throat today. We're very excited. Recovered from her illness.
Finally.
Out. Yes. And our guests, plural, this week, Susan Greening Davis is with us. Hi, Susan.
Hi. How are you both?
Just doing
very
okay.
Very well.
Doing okay. So, good. Susan, this week as we record, which will be when this post 2 weeks ago, is teaching at Sassy Jack's. And a couple days there, I guess, right? 2 days?
Yes, I taught yesterday and I taught today.
All right. And so Kim Young is going to join us at some point, and Kim's in the background somewhere. Yell something, Kim.
Yell at him, Kim.
Hello.
There we go. That was a good yell.
Go.
Yeah. So, Kim
that
back.
Nice southern accent.
Yep. I think this is the quickest return of a guest ever so far.
Well, that's a good thing because she's a brand new shop and it's a great one.
Yep. So, okay. So, well, let's just start. You're stitching, Susan. You're stitching. And Susan is a teacher, cross-stitch samplers, gadget gal. Is that what we read? Yeah, that we got to learn about. Yeah.
Well, okay.
No. Save that. We got to save the gadget gal.
Okay.
So what are you teaching at Sassy Jack's? This is part of Kim's a series of instructors, right?
Yes. We just started yesterday with the beginning of an 18-month sampler study, and I was her first guest. So I had the pleasure of showing many of my vintage sampler collection pieces, and I featured the beginning marking sampler, worked up to the darning samplers, and the plain sewing samplers. And I really, my passion are the young girls that probably were put in charity homes for one reason or the other. And she's going to have some of the other guest teachers coming along the way. I think you already know about Nicola, and she'll be coming. Mm-hmm. So it was really exciting. Brand new shop, 7 weeks, and we had 20 people here that were brand new.
That's great. So, okay, so you're one of those people like Nicola who collects samplers and charts them, or tell us about your sampler interests.
I have only reproduced in charts, I think, 5 now. My passion is to explain the importance of them and how we all got to where we are today, especially in cross-stitch, although some of them have other stitches that were, you know, added along the way. Most people that cross-stitched back then did it for survival. These young girls were put in charity homes or orphanages, and they had to learn a skill. If they didn't have that, they would have probably starved or not had other pleasant choices in their life. And so for me to share that is really exciting. And different countries had different ways that they went about it, and that's where I got addicted to this kind of thing. I have probably about 300 samplers.
Oh, my.
Oh. Yeah.
A little over the top, maybe, huh?
Yeah, just slightly.
We can appreciate that sort of mentality, though. No, it's not like it's nothing we've done before.
You know, I think that all of us that love this kind of work have something that calls our name over and over again. And after 45 years of designing and teaching and educating, I still do that, obviously, because today we had one of my design classes here. It just has become more important when people come and they listen to the lectures and they just shake their heads because they didn't have any idea of the importance of needlework historically. It wasn't just for pleasure and it wasn't just to beautify something.
When you talk about orphanage, you know, girls that were in orphanages, I've heard names of a couple of them where people actually collect as many as they can get from one school or one home or another. Do you have some specialty like that?
I really like from the Netherlands. There were charity homes in Amsterdam, a little different than an orphanage. Unfortunately, an orphanage was very similar to a workhouse where the young children were worked until they passed away. Honestly, they did not get to leave. They were not taught skills. They were just taught, you know, how to farm, how to clothe, clean the new children, whatever was needed. A charity home, which Amsterdam was famous for, took in children and gave them some sort of a trade. And my passion started because of a young girl that was placed in there when her parents were passed away, Sybil. And she taught me a lot about the importance of cross-stitch. She didn't know how to cross-stitch when she was orphaned. And by being placed in this position, they taught her to do our little X's. And along the way, this became her way for survival. And A Journey with Sybil is the book that I actually got to publish with her patterns in her life. So that's, she's the one that got me addicted. And she was actually doing her sampler in 1735.
It's Sybil's fault.
It's Sybil's fault. How does cross stitch itself translate then into a marketable skill? So it's easy to envision, you know, stitching clothing, stitching, you know, functional items, but samplers featuring cross stitch. I'm trying to envision how that particular stitch translates into, something that's, like a usable item.
So you mean for her time, Christine?
Yeah.
For Sybil's time? She was brought into the charity home. She was taught her ABCs by doing cross-stitch. Typically, all of that work was done with a red thread on very coarse linen because, well, children were taught to hold a needle and thread it at 3 years old if they were in the orphanages that young. So Sybil was a little old. And by learning that, we call it a marking sampler. Those were the beginnings, and they would mark the linens from a community. Imagine that the three of us lived in a community, and I happened to be the little girl in the orphanage, and you brought your clothing into the charity home, and I would mark your items, and you would have a certain, as we call it, a font nowadays, but an alphabet that I had stitched, and I would mark your pieces. And the really interesting thing of something I've just acquired is a small little piece that was kind of like a cheat sheet that one of the young girls had, and she had the initials of six families, and underneath each set of initials there was a number, and that told her how many pieces that family had. One family had two pieces, one had six. I think the largest were 10 pieces. So that's how they earned their keep in the very beginning, and raised money to be paid and fed through the charity home.
Okay, I have to be the dumb guy. We're marking pieces of clothing for people in
that's
the community.
Right.
And,
yes.
And to what end is that? I that's where I struggle. I'm with Christine here. I struggle to understand why she would mark for different families.
Because they did all the laundry in the orphanages for the whole
community.
You didn't do your own laundry. Thank you. That's a really good question. I kind of missed that, didn't I? And then if you were of wealth, let's say Gary had a little more money than we did, Christine, he would also have some sort of a crown, or they actually looked like coat of arms. And again, if I was the young girl that was marking things, besides having his initials on there, his mark of a crown or a coat of arms would be embroidered on there.
Oh.
So, if you were to...
Yeah, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah, now I get all these discussions over samplers. I was with Christine. I didn't get how this became something that made them, you know, gave them value in the business world. Now I get it. Okay, all right. So there's just a big pile of clothes at the charity home. And they all got washed, and then that's how they sorted them out.
Exactly. That's exactly how it happened. And then if you don't mind to expound a little bit more,
the time in the world, Susan.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. This is kind of like my thing. You haven't figured that out.
That's then why you're here.
Better embroiderers they were, they would be taught to darn. That was usually their second sampler where they would be mending, which, you know, we don't like to even think about that. We just throw away the socks and get rid of them. But they did more than that kind of mending. They mended furniture, textiles, all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. That kind of work is almost totally lost, except for their pieces where they learn to do the darning. And then the last one I mentioned, the plain sewing samplers, those actually went on until the beginning of the 1900s, where they became a tailor maybe later on in life, because they learned all the skills of buttonholes, pleats, puckering, gathering, And so all of it was one step at a time, but it went back to the 16 and 1700s.
Okay, so now I'm getting it. These samplers that you collect and Nicola collects and all other people collect, they were not pieces of art. They were the training tools.
Right.
Okay.
Most of them were, or they were family documentation.
Mm-hmm.
It's really kind of confusing because obviously some people were very wealthy, I guess is the best word, and they had lots of leisure time. And so they may have created things that were a beauty. I know that Nicola has a Bristol sampler that she spoke about with you. Again,
yes.
That was another orphanage. You know, it was a way that they earned money and they had a specific look. They kind of really did start that way, yes. But now you go into the Victorian age and then they really became pieces of beauty and a lot of ladies in waiting would sit around and embroider for the person that kind of employed them, I guess is the best way of saying it. A lot of the rich ladies didn't embroider all the time. They had people that did the work for them and embellished their clothing and things.
Okay. And for those who don't know, when we talk about Nicola, we're talking about Nicola Parkman of Hands Across the Sea Samplers, who's been our guest on a couple, three occasions, just for people who don't know. And we'll be at Sassy Jack's in January to do a presentation. So, okay. So these girls then would do these samplers. But now another thing that has come to me in discussions primarily with Nicola is that you start to identify some of these samplers with teachers and with schools that there's a, like they have characteristics that some teachers would use?
That's correct. Not all schools put their names on them. Ackworth is very noted for that. A lot of the students there would put Ackworth School on it. Also the same with York, which those two schools were known for their Quaker samplers, which I'll come back to in a minute when you get to talk to Kim. But they did have a look, and if ever there was a distinguishing characteristic, it was because of the country usually. I spoke about how I like samplers from a specific region being Sybil. It's the Netherlands. And, I mean, it's kind of interesting, and it's not a surprise, I suppose, but they have windmills on many of them. One of the things, though, that they're really noted for is a kind of a linen chest that was really only used in that part of the world, and the young girls would put these linen chests on their samplers with a lot of other motifs that all meant something. But those linen chests meant that this was a young girl getting her dowry ready, and she wanted to become a wife to someone.
Hmm. Okay, so they're stitching a chest on there as a symbol of...
that they're a single woman looking to become married. Every single sampler from every country has a meaning behind the symbols that they stitch. We call them the motifs, obviously.
Right.
And that's how you can distinguish schools, countries, regions and countries. I have a black sampler that they were only done for 50 years in part of Germany, only time ever. So it's just really like opening up a treasure chest of knowledge when you get addicted, as I think I probably am, to learning about this and to learning why they were important, again, mainly to women for survival for their families.
Yeah. What's a black sampler?
A black sampler is stitched all in black, first of all, Gary.
Okay.
And it's from a region in Germany. And it has an appearance, a little bit of maybe some of the Quaker samplers as a border. But a lot of it's a mirror image where there's a center motif and then on opposite sides are the same motifs. And they're very distinctive when you look at them. You know, besides being black, you will know that it's a sampler from that region.
This is amazing to me that we can learn so much history just from thread and cloth.
Yeah, a thread, a needle, and an excitement that this industry loves to share. That's what's so cool about all of the stitchers out there. Everybody's willing to share their ideas, and we all have different things that, you know, pique our interest, but yet we're still, I call us a big sisterhood, and you're part of that, Gary.
My heart just got warm right there.
Yeah. As it should.
Okay, so the ones you collect in the Netherlands, done on linen, and then what are we using for thread?
either was pretty much in that part of the world a cotton. Again, unless you had someone that was a benefactor or donated silk. When you would go into Scotland, you would use the wools, and they used many of the threads from their kilts, their sweaters.
Mm-hmm.
England was very much silk. That was a country that had a lot of affluent people, obviously, with their royalties. And so they brought a lot of silk in from France. Ireland, again, being a poor country, used a lot of cottons. And it's all kind of logical.
Yeah, yeah, it starts to make sense because you can see England with their all their ships and all their trading that mm-hmm. they would have the silk. And in the Netherlands, that stuff all hand-dyed?
Yeah, all of the things were hand-dyed, and at that time, obviously, there were no chemicals. They were dyed with natural products, flower thread. That's something that we had in the States for a while, and it wasn't as popular as the company had hoped it would be, so they did discontinue it, but it was replicated from flower thread from Europe. And they called it flower thread because the threads were dyed with natural substances, flowers, bark, you know, that it, and it's a logical thing. The thing that was so good about it and why a lot of people really enjoyed it when we had it, it didn't stain your linen. It always rinsed out clean because it was used natural dyes, mm-hmm. not the chemicals that a lot of our colors have now that we have to be careful of.
So when you buy these old samplers, I mean, it's been my learning that a lot of times the visual part is faded or the colors are somewhat altered, and the way you tell what the true colors are is to look at the backside. Do those natural dyes hold up over all these years?
The silks hold up very well.
Okay.
The cottons, different ones, are surprisingly better. When they had purples, those were some of the hardest to hold on to their color contents. The greens were really good. Blues as well faded. Red held on. It still does. My samplers that have red look as good on the front as they do on the back. It's really an interesting thing. A sampler calls your name. And it might not be the most beautiful sampler in the world to anybody else, or it might be unfinished. I have one that's one of my favorites that's unfinished. But it doesn't really matter how well it's embroidered or what the colors are. It just says, you need to take me home. And mm-hmm. everybody that collects them would tell you that same thing.
I can totally see that because it'll have some motif or something about it that and you may not even know what it is about it that is, you know, hearkening to something for you. But I definitely notice that I do the same thing with pieces, not necessarily even samplers, but other types of embroidery work, hence my growing book collection of things that I intend to do. So your 300 samplers, I'll see your 300 samplers and raise you. I don't know how many books. We'll talk about this in a year.
There you go. We'll compare. If it's okay, because we're kind of talking about different types of samplers and how the colors are and the motifs, I would really like Kim to talk about an adventure that she's starting in her shop with a very special sampler she acquired. Is that okay?
Yeah, sure. Yep.
All right. We're going to hand it off to Kim.
Well, thanks for letting me jump in here. I appreciate it. I had a chance on a trip with Susan on one of her needlework tours to acquire a Quaker sampler that is an authentic Quaker sampler. It's not a reproduction of anything from Erna Hiscock, who's a really great authenticator and dealer in England. And
Kim, I'm going to back you up with a dumb guy question.
Okay.
When we say, I mean, we have samplers, we have band samplers. What makes it a Quaker sampler?
The motifs. So it actually has a set of motifs that are very distinctive for the Quaker schools that produce the samplers. Uh-huh. And they're kind of, some of them are octagonal, some of them are half of an octagon, and they have birds in the center. They have a number of different little decorations, trees, and of course, I know you'll be shocked at this, but squirrels. They have some of the most beautiful squirrels. And I think, you know, I love to see the squirrels. This particular one that I'm going to talk to you about doesn't have a squirrel. So that means I'll be on my quest for a little while until I find one that does. But, but yeah, so they're kind of, some of them are square, you know, I mean, they're just beautiful motifs and they don't all have a border around them. Some of them just sit out on their own. Flowers, they're really very distinctive. Once you see one, you know that it's a Quaker. And they also have, initials in them and numbers. And as Susan mentioned when she spoke earlier, most of the ones from the School of Ackworth actually say Ackworth on them. The one that I collected that I was very privileged to buy in England does not say Ackworth on it, although it has a lot of indications that it may be an Ackworth. But because it doesn't say that on it, and it's sometimes hard to authenticate what school they came from, we're just going to call it a Quaker sampler. But I think anybody who looks at it will immediately say, oh, my gosh, that looks like an Ackworth. And they're probably right. But I was really lucky to be able to pick this one up from Erna Hiscock. Susan was there when I met with Erna, and she kind of pulled Erna aside, and she said, you know, Kim's a new shop owner. And Erna kind of took a look at me, and I don't know if she took pity on me or she was just excited about, you know, a new shop coming into the States. And so she actually sold it to me for something that I could afford, which is another issue with some of these antiques is that they're just really hard to come by, which, of course, then makes them, you know, if they're of this kind of quality, difficult for you know, somebody to afford. So I'm really lucky. I'm super excited about it. And Susan and I talked about it, and it's very beautiful. And we didn't want to just hoard it and keep it to ourselves. And so we thought about it, and we decided to create a sampler club, a chapter club for the sampler, which, you know, what we did with it is we charted it, and it's a beautiful chart format. Susan wrote with each chapter a little bit of information on Quaker schools, primarily Ackworth and York, because that's what we see most of the Quaker samplers coming out of. And so you know, with each chapter, and there are 10 chapters in this club, with each one you get a set of motifs, usually three, because there are a number of them on the sampler, and then you get the historical information that Susan wrote up for me. So she kind of partnered with me because this is my first one, you know, and really helped me get it off the ground and put it together in a beautiful format. And so the way that we are going to offer it is 10 parts. And the first part includes the fabric, all the fabric, and the fibers, which there are a number of fibers for it, and the first chapter. And the chapter itself includes the motifs. There are three in the first one, as well as the introduction and the historical part, which to me is just brings the whole thing together, that Susan wrote. And after that, there are 9 more chapters. They'll be published at the beginning of each month in a PDF format, either in a secret Facebook group, meaning that you have to be admitted to that group by me, or if you really don't like to do Facebook, then we'll do it through email. And so you'll get an email or you'll log on to Facebook at the beginning of each month, you know, after you've signed up, and you can download the chart. So the first chapter, because it includes the fabric and the fiber, and we're just basically covering the cost of that, is $75. And then the 9 successive chapters are $15 each. So it's really affordable, and it's very manageable to stitch, because that's what happens a lot of times. People love the look of the sampler. You know, they want to be able to stitch it, and then they just get overwhelmed sometimes because they're often large. But breaking it into the different motifs makes it really manageable, and it's kind of a wonderful thing to do each month to get this new set of motifs, and they're all different, you know, and appreciate them for what they are. This particular sampler, Quaker sampler, has a lot of color in it. It's just gorgeous. So it's got not just a number of motifs and alphabets and numbers and stuff, but just lots of color in it. And we charted it two ways. The front of the sampler, which is, of course, what was exposed over the years, is charted with gentle arts fiber. So it's a little bit more subtle coloring to it. And then we also gave the person who buys the chart the DMC equivalent that's a brighter color palette. So if you want to stitch it as it was original on the back, you can see that. You can do it with the DMCs. And this one has not too many that are too different, but there are a few that were brighter in the beginning, and then, you know, others that kind of held their color. So I kind of rambled on there, but I'll kind of give you the lowdown. Again, it's an authentic Quaker sampler that we acquired in England. I'm really lucky to have it. We've charted it. We are going to release it as a chapter club with 10 parts. The first one has all the fibers in the fabric, at least three motifs in each chapter, and the next 9 come out at the beginning of the month. The second one will come out in October, and then run through until we get to the 10th and final chapter. And then the really cool part about it is at the end of it, we're going to have a gathering, here in Asheville again. I think we'll do it here. And we have some really special things put together for it, which I don't want to go into a lot of detail at this point. I kind of want to save some of that. But we've got some really special related, gifts, I'll call them, to be included, you know, with this chapter. You don't have to finish it. You just have to be signed up. And then when we get to the end, you know, you'll get an invitation to come here with us to the gathering. And if you can't, you know, and I understand that there's some people who it's a pretty great distance for, we'll ship that to you. So you'll still get everything that we would give everybody else, even if you can't come to the gathering. But if you do get to come, it'll be really awesome. So I'm looking forward to that too. So that's my spiel on that.
That's fun. So it starts when?
Now, yesterday. Oh. So you better sign up, Gary.
So when this is posted, then it'll have started 2 weeks before. Okay, got it.
Yes, and so what we'll do is the first chapter is going to be out there, and only the first chapter until October the 1st, and anybody can sign up during that time. Then at that point, the second chapter will get posted or emailed. And if you were to sign up, let's say when we were on chapter 3, so you signed up in November when chapter 3 had been published, you would actually have to pick up the first, second, and third chapter, because they're all going to be published in the Facebook group. So since they'll all be out there, you know, you would have to catch up with us basically. You don't have to stitch it all to catch up with us, but we'll issue, you know, you'll have the patterns available through that time period. So it just kind of keeps it easier and cleaner. And the Facebook group thing is going to be really fun because we'll get to see progress pictures. And I truly believe that people are going to stitch this. This is not one that's going to sit in their stash because it's so manageable and it is so pretty. And the one thing I didn't mention is that there's a lot of cross stitch on here, but when we took this out of the glass, which we did immediately after we bought it, we realized that a lot of the letters were beautiful, tiny eyelets, and they are just gorgeous. And they set the sampler off, you know, and under glass, you just couldn't see it. It was old glass, you know, it was as clean as it could be, but it was still not perfectly clean. And as soon as we got it out into the air, the thing just kind of came alive. It was just really amazing. And the people in the room all leaned in and were like, oh my gosh, it's just that pretty. And so, you know, I've got it here in the shop. And so if people come through the shop, they'll get to see it, and appreciate it in person, the antique. And I think that people are just going to love stitching it. I'm really curious to see what motif is a favorite of the different people, you know, and what they like about the colors and how many people stitch it in, you know, the bright colors versus what it is now, which it's still very beautiful and lots of the colors are bright. And I've got it right in front of me. And you know, Susan talked about the red. The red is still the brightest color on this sampler, which kind of blows my mind because things today stitched with red sometimes fade,
right.
you know. And I don't know what was different about the fiber, you know, 150, 200 years ago, but I don't see red faded out as much as I do a lot of the other colors. So it's kind of neat. Red thread has a pretty significant meaning in samplers, which I'll leave that to Susan to talk about if she feels like. But red thread is pretty interesting in the sampler world, too. It has some meaning to it. So I love to see the red in the samplers, but... So thank you. That's pretty exciting stuff.
Yeah. Okay. And
no,
of course,
not at all.
Of course, you're going to send a picture of the sampler so we can put it with the podcast here so people can see it.
You bet.
Yes.
You bet. Yeah. We'll make sure you get that. All right. I figured we could talk you into it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love how this is structured too. Just the way that sort of the chapters are being parsed out because it gives you something to look forward to, but it also gives you time to actually stitch the piece, you know, because I think sometimes that doesn't, you don't, you know, you get rushed when you're taking a class over a couple of days. So I like these long sort of distance learning type classes.
Yeah, and that's, you know, one of the things that I, not to jump off on the Sassy Jacks too much, but one of the things that's really important to me is education. And not everybody can travel all the time. And so it's very important to me to pursue a few other avenues. And one of them is something like this, where you've got an online learning, a distance learning kind of thing. We, you know, Susan will probably mention some of her trips that she does, needle work trips, but we've got some coming up that I'm going to really be, I'm going to put on my most persuasive Southern, accent and smile and try to talk some of the needle craftswomen that we're going to get to meet into doing some things like this, you know, and, be able to share that with my stitchers who can't, you know, always travel. So I'm really looking into things, and you guys gave me this idea, so I appreciate it, into Skype and podcast and trying to make things more accessible, you know, and just broaden the horizon of the folks who know and love needlework and, you know, and even people who physically can't travel anymore. I mean, you know, we all have our issues in life, and there are certain periods in time where you just can't get out, and I don't want people to feel isolated. There's still, you know, Susan called us a sisterhood, and, you know, we've got some men in there too, brotherhood, but, you know, I want people to feel included, and I want them to have that chance. And so there's a few different things I kind of have in my tool bag that I'm going to be trying to pull out, and this is the first of that. So good point. Appreciate that. Yeah.
Great.
So
good for you. That's terrific. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yep. Okay. So Susan's coming back.
I'm here.
Oh, that was a quick switch.
We're pretty good here.
Thank you.
I am so much indebted to shops over the years. And you all know we have a hard time. Many of them we have lost. Some are, you know, getting older and retiring. And to have some new shops coming in is very exciting. So thank you for letting me share her information.
Oh, sure. Okay, she used a word that I keep forgetting to ask when we talk about samplers. I mean, samplers are sold basically in the art world, and counterfeits and fakes and all those things are prevalent. Authentication, what is the process? What makes you sure that you have an authentic sampler? Is there some key things that people look for when they buy these things that to make
Definitely,
sure you're, it's
yeah.
legit?
Yes, definitely. And that's a really good question. I'm really happy that you asked that. First of all,
I specialize in that. That's no problem.
Christine, does he run this over you before he comes up with these ideas?
You know, he's a loose cannon. I just stand out of the way.
Okay. First of all, you really need to be aware of who you're dealing with and who you're purchasing something from. Kim noted one of the best people in England, Ernest, just really reputable, and they will give you all of the paperwork, all of the history that they have found or researched or documented, or if they don't have any, you know, they're very honest with you. They'll say, you know, we know that this is of this era. We know because of the fabric. We know because of the threads that were used. And again, I go back to the motifs. But it's really difficult to go online, and I do buy things online, but I know who I'm working with. I know that they're going to follow through and give me information and ask any question I ask them, they're going to answer. I have a couple other friends that are really, really good. We have one in Germany that we're going to be visiting in a little bit. Some of you are familiar with the name Lorraine Mutz. She was on Sampler and Antique Quarterly many times before we lost that magazine with her samplers, that she reproduced. Martin X, which as people will say, is that really his name? Yes, it is really his name in Amsterdam, is another person if you really, really want to have something that you know is real. Online, you can make things look old. You know, we kind of laugh about it. And we have the beautiful fabrics now that many of them are made to look like they're old pieces. So you have to go to someone you can trust. And usually they'll have paperwork for you.
Yeah, okay. It just seems like you can probably get tripped up no matter how experienced you are.
Yeah, you have to be really careful. And again, though, it's kind of like you said, your books, Christine, sometimes, and I think it's probably happened to everybody, I admit it's happened to me, one calls your name, and the more you investigate or the more you look at it, you think, well, that's probably not exactly quite what I thought it was. But that's kind of why I've really try to go with people that I know and trust. And yet, you all know the story. You go to a garage sale and you see a beautiful piece of work and someone in the family didn't love it or care about it and it's for a dollar. I have a hard time leaving any.
Yep.
Somebody did that and loved it, every stitch they did.
Right, right, yeah. Shouldn't go to waste. Shouldn't go.
No.
What were needles like back then? I mean, we have, you know, beautiful, smooth, well-shaped, durable needles. What were they like? They must have been pretty crude devices.
Yeah, and, you know, it's really logical if you start thinking about it. It would have been a bone from some animal or possibly a twig, something that had to be hand-carved. And it was very exciting when the first metal needle was created. We had the opportunity of seeing one in Germany many years ago that, again, it was a single needle. It wasn't mass-produced. That came along a little later. And it's in a small little museum in Germany. Trying to make a needle, there are about 70 steps. And you look at this one needle, and it was very large and very clunky. It wouldn't have been something they could have done fine embroidery on. But the process made it durable, you know, versus a piece of bone or a piece of twig. I have to tell you a little story, if it's okay. I was on an adventure with a bunch of people that I didn't really know not that long ago. And this is true. We all start stitching and we love it and we pick up what we have. And if we aren't fortunate enough to have a shop or something, you know, you don't always have the necessary tools or the things that make it better. And I had a girl that was sitting next to me and she was having a really difficult time with a fiber. And I don't ever say anything when I'm not the teacher. I'm very quiet, believe it or not. And finally, she was just sputtering. I said, can I show you maybe a trick on how that fiber will behave a little better? She handed me her needle and the eye was broken.
Oh my. Ah.
And she was stitching. And so I kindly said, you know, I have a needle that I really like. And if you don't mind, I would like to switch and use my needle. And so, you know, she said, fine. So I was stitching and I showed her a couple tricks and she said, oh, okay, I'll put it back on my needle. I said, no, I said, why don't you just use mine? It's already loaded, which is a term, unfortunately, I use, load your needles. And yeah, I do.
I like some... that. I'm taking that.
In class, I tell them to get loaded and I don't even drink anymore. But anyway, so she started using it and she was just like, oh my gosh, what is this needle? Well, to make a very long story short, besides broken eyes, people use sewing needles and different things. We are just definitely in needle heaven around this United States, especially because we have so many different types and so many different qualities. But historically, no, they would have been working with something very crude. And this is a cool thing, too. If we all lived in a community together and there was one needle that was very good, not a twig or a bone, and let's say it was mine and I was passing away, I would will it to the very best stitcher in the whole community, boy or girl, didn't matter.
Oh.
That's how precious a good needle was.
It makes sense. It really does. Yeah.
Because that person was going to pick up and mend things and, you know, it's just, all of that stuff is just really something that catches my attention.
Hmm. So then, so I have two questions then. For you now, what is your favorite type of needle to stitch samplers with? And what would the original needles most resemble in modern needles now as far as shape, size, type? Okay. Because there's so many different types.
Right. It's really difficult for me to say overall which needle I prefer because I work on all different kinds of fabrics and all different counts of fabrics, and I teach all different kinds of stitches.
Mm-hmm.
That all makes a difference. If we're talking cross-stitch and we're talking on linens, basic linens going up to even a 32 or a 36 count, hold on to your hats, kids. Mm-hmm. You should be using a 22 needle if you're using two strands. And that's what the needle companies encourage. Now, whatever you like and makes your heart happy, use it. Don't just, you know, because I said so. But I teach a lecture, and I've taught it all over the world, actually. And it's really kind of a giggle when people would look at me and they'll be really upset. Oh, I don't use that big of a needle. And then they'll try it, and they'll come back and they'll go, oh my gosh, my threads lay smoother. Besides, you can thread it easier. And you don't, you know how we move our needles along and the threads can ruffle? It doesn't happen. Plus, it opens up the holes on your fabric and the thread glides through and it doesn't catch. So that's important. Now, if you're going to backstitch and, you know, do other things, you're going to use always a finer needle. But that's the way they were meant to be. 24 is really good too. 26 is really good for backstitching or a single strand. And honestly, the 28s are for really, really, really almost church linens and beading. So it's, I know it blows some people's minds because they are proud when they say, oh, I use a really, really tiny needle. And I used to always think to myself, well, it's probably because you can thread it and I can't. but a larger eyed needle is really important for your fiber and your linen.
Yeah, that was one of the best things that actually one of the best first tips that Gary gave me because it was the first time I was working with fibers that were dimensional instead of just DMC threads, you know, working with things that were ribbons. And he said, well, what kind of needle are you using? And I said, a needle. And he said, use a bigger needle because I was afraid to dilate the hole in the canvas because I thought that it wouldn't go back. And he said, nah, don't worry about it. And it was exactly as you said. It would spread the canvas apart. The thread would lie perfectly smoothly and then it would fold back up again and everything just, it was magically so much easier.
Bravo, Gary. Yes.
Yeah.
Good job.
Every now and then I trip over one, you know, every now and then.
Yep. That was a mind blowing one. And because I was thinking the same thing, like the less you disturb the canvas, the better. And in fact, it was quite the opposite. And so that made a big, big, big difference for me.
Susan, you teach everywhere. What are the kinds of things that you run into that are hurdles for people and how do you help them over it? I mean, the needle thing, a broken eye, yeah, to help somebody get past that, that's huge. but you must run into stuff all the time where it once people are past that, they're flying.
I'm going to use today's class as a really good example. The piece that I created for Kim's shop is a drum pin cushion. And it has basic stitches and a little bit of fancy stitch in it and a few different fibers. And so besides teaching them what goes together for, you know, a needle and a thread combination for a stitch, I had beginners here who had not cross-stitched before on linen. I had people here that had stitched for 30-some years. And that's what I run into a lot, and I love it when that happens because I get to hopefully challenge someone that's really, you know, proficient, and yet I get to open up the door for the excitement that we know from our needlework. The biggest challenge that happens a lot are threading the needles, no doubt. That seems to be a troublesome thing, and it's usually because they have the wrong needle. They don't have an eye that's big enough, or they don't have the correct style of eye to suit the ribbon or the wool or the cotton or the silk. So once we get over that, because I give out a lot of needles in my class for all of that, you know, counting is a big thing. I can't count for you. I can check your counting, but I can't really count for everybody in class. And people get nervous in class, even experienced stitchers a lot of times. And if you were here, I teach a little different than most people. I mean, we have kind of a party in all my classes, although when it's time to be serious, we're very serious. So it was a nice mix of the person that was really nervous because she knew she had somebody sitting beside her that was an expert. The National Embroiderers Guild Association is going on right here in Asheville now. So that gives you a clue of some of the people that were here. They've been stitching a long time.
Yeah.
And then Kim has brought in some of these newbies. So that's where I find the challenge. Again, we go back to the wrong needle. And then I don't think all of the charts that are used as teaching charts sometimes are as thorough as they should be. I'm really firm with myself when I work with my charter that someone can take the chart even if they couldn't stay for the whole class or if they became ill and couldn't make it to the class. They can do the project. They don't learn all the little tips I give them. And I have intimate moments, or what I call my time, when I sit down and people watch me. I'm left-handed, but I can stitch both hands. So it's really kind of cool because I can have my lefties come and watch how to do a stitch, and then I can have my righties. But I had a good thing today happen that happens every once in a while. I'm of a certain generation where they didn't like girls to be left-handed. So we were slapped on the wrist, and forks were put in our other hands.
Susan, I'm bonding with you right now. I went through that. You know, those are my childhood traumas, is that very thing. Yeah, you can't hold the pencil in your left hand. It has to be in your right hand. Has to point over your shoulder. I can't see what I'm writing if it points over. Yeah, all that stuff. Yes,
see,
thank you.
Only lefties understand that.
Right.
Besides the fact I had left-handed students today because they were excited because they'd had some times that weren't so cool. I had a lady that was very confused on a stitch I was teaching, and I looked at her and I watched her and I said, "Were you left-handed and somebody changed you to being a right-handed person?" She looked at me and she said, "How did you know that?" I said, "Because I lived that life." And that's the thing that happens. Most patterns and stitches are created for the right-handed world. And it's one of my, I think one of the gifts that I was given from somebody, angels or something, that I really can do both ways. It helps everybody calm down. That helps too, I guess. They know that it doesn't matter if you're left-handed or right-handed. We're going to get it. We're going to get it done.
Okay. Yep. All right. You, me, and Yvette are going to get together and just have a left-handed stitching thing. Yes.
We need to start our own club.
That's right. That's right. Darn it. Yes. Okay. We're going to run out of time, and I cut you off on the original Gadget Gal thing. So tell that story.
Okay. I've designed and I've educated and taught for 45 years. So that kind of gives you a clue where I'm at in the age group.
Yep.
And when I started traveling,
young.
I was a babe in arms.
Yes.
When I started traveling, I realized that people didn't understand about gadgets and what worked and what didn't work. And I've been known in the industry as Sherlock Holmes because companies will come to me and they'll say, "You have to tell us what you think of this." I won't say I'm blunt, but I'm very honest. And if something isn't of the quality it should be, and if you ask me, I will tell you. I would never embarrass anybody. But that's how it all started. People would ask questions. How do I use this? How do I do this? And when we had so many of the really, really large big shows, which unfortunately we have very few left now, I was the gadget girl. I would do a presentation, 45 minutes, usually every day, and show people how to use the gadgets that were out there. And it was a great hoot. The fun thing is, that's really not who I am. I'm a designer and a teacher and an educator. But along the way, people will come up to me and they go, "I took your Gadget Girl class 20 years ago and I still know this and this." And I just have to giggle because it was a great way to get my name out there publicly, I guess. And now here I am, the historical sampler addict. It's changed a lot over the years.
Yes, yes.
I teach them about their tools, though. I mean, I got asked today 3 or 4 different questions on tools. So that was a good thing to start out with. And it makes me giggle.
Yeah, so, it makes sense, though. Because those are some of the things that make your job easier, right? You can do without them, but then they're the things that, like I said, just make everything so much nicer and fun.
Well, and you know from what you said, changing the needle, you enjoyed it more, didn't you?
Mm-hmm, absolutely. It just made it so much. The thing that was frustrating and made the stitching not look as good as I wanted it to, just by changing the tool, the stitching was beautiful, and I was a lot happier doing it. So I think the tools, having the right tool for the job is crucial. So I wouldn't even laugh at that. That makes perfect sense to me to do it that way.
Yeah. I've always said, whatever makes your heart happy. That's what I've said as long as I've taught stitching. And if a tool can make something better, it's going to probably make you happy.
What are some of the truly useful tools? Because Christine and I have had discussions more than once about the infrastructure of stitching and, you know, all the pieces. What are some of the truly useful things you've encountered, and what are just some of the really dumb things?
Oh, we got to be careful. Well, definitely we start out with the needle. It is the number one thing. You have to have the needle that works. And these are basics. Scissors. And there are a lot of different scissors out there that are for different types of needlework. And it's not just one pair. Most of us have lots of them anyway, so we're pretty much covered. But you will learn the more you get into different types of embroidery, you know, what kind of stitch or scissors work that well. I always have the discussion when I teach a class of whether you should use hoops or frames or in your hand or all that. And I always tell my students, first of all, whatever you prefer. But again, it depends on the kind of embroidery you're doing. Some things need to be on a frame. When we're doing pulled work, you have to have all four sides stabilized. Sometimes you're doing crewel work, you want to use a hoop because of the way the pattern is, you know, laid out. And then for a lot of us that are doing our cross stitch and our basic work, we do it in our hand, which was historically the way they did it. What mm-hmm. would be so, oh, this is hard for me to talk about things that aren't good. I don't want anybody coming after me. One of the things that they
you don't have, you don't have to, that's okay.
Oh, no, she definitely does.
Okay.
You guys are getting crazy. This is one of the things that we talk about when, you know, you have threads and sometimes they don't behave the way you like them to. Okay. First of all, a lot of threads just really like the warmth of your hands and they like to have you, you know, run your hand down them and it relaxes them. Some threads just don't know how to be nice. And there was a company, and if they're still out there, okay, that they sold sponges that you wet and you ran your thread over them. Now, first of all, you should never stitch with anything that's wet. It's a good way to find out if something's going to bleed, but yeah. It's not a tamer. It's a sponge, and they made a lot of money. So we have products out there now that are okay, but it still goes back to the basic of a really good clean wax. That's what they used historically, although you know where their wax came. Do I have to say it? Earwax.
Yeah.
So, though that's probably the funkiest, craziest, throw it away if you have one. And you think about a sponge, you know, they aren't very hygienic. So, is that good enough, Gary? Good enough, Christine?
Well, yeah. Okay, all right, now.
I think there are much better waxes available now if you are so inclined to wax a thread, beeswax. We don't have to do that other thing.
No. And you don't need to use any of those things if you get more happy with your threads. And again, the warmth of your hand calms many threads down.
Okay. I got to back up to the sponges because I am a proud owner of one of those sponges.
Oh, gee. I should have known.
But I'll tell you why. I was doing a piece and I won't say the name of the silk. But I was using a silk that it was just had this flyaway characteristic to it. It just drove me nuts. I couldn't keep it under control. And someone said to just dampen it and it will settle down and behave. And so I used a very damp, I bought one of those little tiny sponges that comes in a really nice little box and used that and it did. It helped that silk. And it allowed me to stitch with it because I was about to throw the piece in the trash because I just had it. And, and it made it behave. So I own one of those sponges, but now I will never use it again. What do I use then?
Really, you should use wax. Water
so
is a good on silk. Yes. 100% pure, clean beeswax. And we have companies out there now that do the cutest darn little things. Little sheep, little bees, you know, little hedgehogs. And so you can kind of feel really funky and fun while you use it. Silk, honestly,
I live to feel funky and fun right there.
Yeah, there you go.
Gary is just the epitome of funky and fun, I'll just say. I have a little tin. It's not a tin. It's a plastic container of the and I don't remember the name of it and I don't have it in front of me. It's not wax technically. It's white. It comes in a blue box.
Yes. I know what you're talking about.
It's Wonder Stitchy Magical something of I forget what it was.
Was
that helps a little bit.
For the bead industry and then it entered the quilting industry and we do have it in our industry. It's great. The only thing I would be aware of is if you are going to do a sampler that you want to be around for 100 or so years, beeswax is natural. That has a little chemical in it. And you know, I'm just going to throw this in. The very most important thing that gets stitched is a baby sampler, because that's something that's forever. Not a wedding sampler, I'm sorry. you know, I mean, I've been doing this for 45 years. Baby samplers, no matter what, are the most wonderful keepsake. And just to throw in one little thing, because I know maybe we're going on too long. When children were born during this era that I'm talking about, if I would have been the first girl named Susan and I passed away, there would have been no documentation, and the second girl in that family probably would have been named Susan too. So baby samplers are really, really important, and they should be done with silk and beeswax and something that's preserved.
Sorry. Okay, I gotta get back. No, I gotta get back to this beeswax. So, okay, so I have a roundish plastic holder with a disc of beeswax in it that I bought long ago when I was messing around with candle wicking.
Yes.
And so the question I have is, I mean, that beeswax been sitting around in the open air forever. Is that mm-hmm. still good, or should I, you know, how long does it last, I guess, is the question.
Okay, if it's protected in something, it could probably last forever. The top of yours, if it's been out in the air, I would say you would scrape it off, because okay. it sounds like the rest of it's contained, just to get the impurities out, because, you know, we know what flies around in the air. You never know what it could be, mm-hmm. ashes. I mean, even if you're not a smoker, there are different things. But it lasts forever if it's in a container and it's held. So just wipe the top off that, Gary, and put it in your hands and warm it up, and it'll be ready to go. Rock and roll. You'll be stitching.
All right, learn something. See, this is great. Now my sponge. Let's talk about my sponge.
How old is it? I want to know how old it is.
It's not even two.
Scary.
It's not even 2 years old. It's a beautiful yellow little sponge.
All right, now let me ask you: how long would you keep a sponge that you were doing your dishes in the sink with? 2 years?
Exactly.
I don't think
yeah.
so.
Oh, yeah. Three, probably. No.
Oh, no.
Anyway, make
it dirt. It's going downhill fast.
Okay.
I got the message. The sponge is going to the trash as soon as we're done. I got it.
All right. Yeah. It's not dangerous.
You know what you could do, Gary, though? You should use the flat iron technique on that silk. I bet you that would help.
Yeah, yeah. That's a good idea.
Instead I gotta get me one of those.
Wetting it.
Yeah. I gotta get one.
That helps a ton.
Yeah. Okay, learn something. See, there you go. Thank you,
that
Susan.
That really does. After all the people you've spoken to, and I have to tell you, it really is exciting to see whose names pop up. Again, I've been doing this for 45 years, I think almost longer than anybody that's still doing it. And I know the people, and it's really fun to listen to them and to hear the questions you ask and to never know exactly where you're coming from.
Well, we feel exactly the same way, so.
Oh. All right, we're going to end it right there. This has been a blast. Thanks, Susan, for taking the time. Sure appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for your patience getting me worked in your schedule.
Worked out great. All right, and that's going to end it, this episode of Fiber Talk. And Christine and I will be back on Wednesday. Thanks for listening.
Take care.